how much of the circle extended between Cyrene and Alexandria, about 7 degrees. There's no fancy way to get around the next step. Eratosthenes needed to know the actual distance from Alexandria to Cyrene. So he paid some camel caravan drivers to go from one town to the other and tell him how far it was. A few achy-footed camels later, the answer came back, 500 miles. So if 500 miles equals 7 degrees of the circle, the whole circle must be 25,000 miles. Eratosthenes' answer, deduced with nothing but two sticks, some tired camels, and a brain, is within a few percent of being correct. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by William Oram with help from physicist Stephen Gervin. I'm Don Glass.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, the same square with a new angle, now with shops, offices, activity, and dining facilities, including Pretty Nails and Mr. John's School of Cosmetology.
In sports, the St. Louis Cardinals have agreed to terms with compensatory draft pick Lance Lynn, a right-handed pitcher and the career strikeouts leader at Mississippi. Lynn was the 39th overall pick of the draft after going 7-4 with 100 strikeouts as a junior, second most on the team. He finished his career with 332 strikeouts and the only player in school history over 300. The 6'5", 260-pound player from Brownsburg, Indiana, set a single season record with 146 strikeouts as a sophomore while going 8-5. The Cardinals will try to continue their success against their cross-state rivals when they open a three-game Interstate 70 series versus the Kansas City Royals at Busch Stadium. St. Louis has taken advantage of its yearly matchups with Kansas City, going 26-19 against the Royals since interleague play began in 1997. The Cubs are back in action tonight in Florida, where they'll take on the Tampa Bay Rays. The Cubs bring a 45-25 record into the opener of the three-game set. The Rays, meanwhile, are 40-29. The White Sox open a three-game home series against the Pittsburgh Pirates tonight. Chicago holds a 4.5-game lead over Minnesota in the AL Central. And after failing to seal the deal in Los Angeles, the Celtics return to Boston with another chance to secure their 17th NBA championship and end a 22-year title drought. They'll play the Lakers in Game 6 of the best-of-seven league finals, two nights after losing Game 5 to the Lakers 103-98. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs. Eastern Rug Gallery also offers a cleaning and repair service, 1402 South Neal in Champaign.
It's 2:43. This is the Afternoon Magazine. The Mississippi River continues to rise rapidly in western Illinois, but residents of a small river town there were managing to hold it at bay, Rich Egger reports.
A wall of white sandbags lines East 1st Street in Dallas City. In some places, the wall is a couple feet high, in others, it rises more than 5 feet. On one side of the wall, a green Montana tractor carries more sandbags in its bucket. Volunteers haul them out and toss them onto the levee. On the other side of the wall, the river is well out of its banks, but so far, the levee is rising faster than the river.
I think we'll make it. Got a good bunch down there helping and everything.
That bunch is working near Bob Byers' home. He needs their help. Byers is 84 and has undergone a couple heart surgeries. Physically, there's not much he can do to fight the flood, but he'll do whatever he can, even if it's simply driving a pickup truck to bring over more sandbags. In addition to the sandbag levee, there are pumps and pipes along the street near Byers' home. The pumps suck up whatever water seeps through. That water gets sent along pipes and hoses and is poured right back into the Mississippi. These are tense times as the community waits for the river to crest and fall, but Byers' spirits remain high.
We got to think positive, I guess. When you look up the river, what's happened up there, we're mighty lucky. Mighty lucky.
Steve Roberts is lucky. His home in Dallas City is not threatened by floodwaters. Yet the retired crane operator spent the past few days filling sandbags and shoring up levees.
We'll fight it till the end. That's all we can do. The way I look at it is every sandbag's another bullet. Even filling sandbags, whether you're holding bags or whether you're filling or driving a truck or a piece of machinery, it's very important to the effort.
Roberts worked with others in front of the water plant on First Street. The group is smaller than it was over the weekend because many volunteers headed back to their jobs Monday morning. It's also a smaller group a couple blocks away, where the Redneck Beach Party took place over the weekend.
We had the sand unloaded here, so we thought we might as well have a beach party. So
that sand was dumped on West First Street right in front of Annie Miller's house. The same could not be done now because that part of the street is underwater. In fact, the water goes right up to her front yard where another sandbag levee blocks the river.
It's come up about 3 or 4 inches this morning. And now we're getting all this wind, and that doesn't help anything.
Still, Miller feels her house should be safe, so she's off to help others.
I'm hauling down to the neighbors. 5 houses down, they're in real bad shape, so they're playing catch-up, trying to save it. It just about went last night, but so far they're still holding it, but a lot of sand.
It's that spirit of community, of working together and helping others, that's enabled Dallas City residents to build the levee so quickly. That quick response was needed. 2 weeks ago, nobody talked about the possibility of a major flood on the Mississippi this year. But then areas to the north got socked with torrential rainstorms, followed by devastating floods. All of that water needed to go somewhere, and in many cases, that somewhere was the big river. Now the water is moving swiftly downstream and impacting the lives of Byers, Miller, and many others in many of the towns along the mighty Mississippi. Rich Egger reporting.
More than a dozen people sandbagging a levee before it broke near the western Illinois town of Gulfport had to be rescued by helicopter when the Mississippi burst its banks today. Today's breach forced the closure of the Great River Bridge that connects the small village of Gulfport to Burlington, Iowa. The rising waters also threatened to deluge farmland. Governor Blagojevich's office says motorists stranded on U.S. 34 and people in a house in the town of Carmen were also rescued. China and India share a border, and they share astonishingly rapid growth rates. The two countries together are the subject of a crop of new books that Vishak Desai has been reading. She is president of the Asia Society in New York and is helping review the books. NPR's Steve Inske spoke with her.
Let's start with a book here on the stack that is maybe the one with the title that's most likely to give an American heartburn, The New Asian Hemisphere, The Irresistible Shift of Global Power to the East.
That's by my friend Kishore Mahbubani, and it is very true that Mahbubani has been talking about this issue of rise of Asia for some time. But he has begun to talk about making sure that America particularly, but the West in general, recognizes that there is a shift underway.
He quotes some basic numbers here just to say who has a greater percentage of the world economy, and he argues that if you went back 2,000 years, you'd find that the overwhelming amount of economic activity was in Asia, and the vast majority has been in Asia, except for the last couple of centuries.
Well, for sure, Chinese often will tell you today, because they're very historically conscious, to say as late as 1600, 50% of world's GDP actually was in Asia. So last 250 years, some people might say, is just an exception.
Meaning that it would be natural to go back the other way?
Some Chinese have said that.
And does this book, The New Asian Hemisphere, present evidence suggesting that that is in fact what's happening now?
Well, let's put it this way. There will be a much larger percentage of the world's economic growth in Asia, particularly driven by China, India, but also Japan, Southeast Asia, etc. Kishore is perhaps too overly optimistic that it's all a foregone conclusion. I think that we have to recognize likelihood of America being a sole superpower is very, very small. But how America handles this and how Asia, especially China and India, handle their new global power status is also still a question that we have to deal with.
Well, let's move on to the next book on our stack here. And this is a stack of books, not just on China, not just on India, but on the pair together and the significance of them. The book is called Billions of Entrepreneurs.
Yes, this is by Tarun Khanna. His big message is to say that India and China are going to begin to have to work together more, that it is not simply that they can be seen as competitors, but they're going to have to be much more of collaborators, because what India does well, such as individual entrepreneurship without the interference from the state, versus what China does well, which has to do with state planning, macroeconomic planning to make things like infrastructure work, is something India really is going to have to do more of. And if India is the back office of the world, India is going to have to get more into other kinds of manufacturing, and China is going to have to do more of service economy.
So the books on our stack here are The New Asian Hemisphere, Billions of Entrepreneurs, and one more here, Bill Emmett's book, Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade.
I think it's very interesting, if you think about Bill Emmett, that that book is much more focused on political issues among these three countries. Khanna's book is much more focused on the economic advantage. And Mabubani, he's trying to pull together the economic and to some extent political together. You need to read all three books, first of all, because all of them are making an argument that you need to understand what's going on in Asia, and you need to understand the complexity of the situation, so that if you only look at the economic, you're not going to get it right. If you only look at the political, which is what Emmett does, you probably also will make some mistakes. I personally also add a third element, and that is that India and China are ancient civilizations. They are politically, let's say, 50, 60 years old, given their trajectory of the 20th century.
Just to clarify that, communist China is 50, 60 years old, and India has had about 60 years since independence from Britain.
Exactly. And economically, you might say that India is an adolescent, about 16 years old, given economically the opening and what happened with the economy. China is about 30 years old. But culturally, these are more than 5,000-year-old civilizations. And in all of these countries, these three elements, how they come together is what we need to understand. So if Emmett talks about how mainly 20th century, but also even the last 200 years of histories of these countries suggest that they're going to be rivals, they're going to be looking at each other over their shoulder, there isn't a lot of trust, that we can't just keep moving on to this agenda that Asia is going to rise lock, stock, and barrel together. I think that there is some truth to that, but I think that you also have to recognize that intra-Asian trade today is among the fastest trading patterns in the world.
There's a lot of trade between China and India, say?
Today, China has now surpassed U.S. as India's largest trading partner.
Does that mean that the United States can feel comfortable, if that's the word, that China and India are going to effectively balance each other? There's not going to be a dominant player in Asia, and we don't have to worry about them so much.
Well, some people will say that indeed that's the case. Others have said, what if they come together? Because there is this assumption that when countries come together, somehow they're going to gang up on somebody else. There are two big phenomena out there. One is that the world is more interdependent than ever before. Number two, in that level of globalization is the rise of China and India and other parts of Asia. So we need to figure out the role we're going to play, not just to balance, but also as an active, responsible participant, so that we don't have to feel that we're the only ones who have all the answers, because that may not be the case.
The books are The New Asian Hemisphere, Billions of Entrepreneurs, and Rivals. They were all reviewed here by Vishakha Desai of the Asia Society. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Vishakha Desai spoke with NPR's Steve Inskeep. Environmental activists are calling for food packagers to stop using toxic plastic to line food and beverage cans. Lester Graham reports.
The thin plastic lining used in many canned foods and soft drinks contains a chemical called bisphenol A. Canada is taking steps to restrict the use of the plastic in baby